Pavel Prigozhin, the son and heir of the late Wagner founder, apparently has South Africa on his radar. We speak to SA Russia expert Professor Irina Filatova to find out more. Welcome, Professor.
Hello, Chris.
Professor, what have you heard about Pavel's interest in Southern Africa and in particular in South Africa?
Look, there was a BBC Russian service investigation into this issue. Their conclusion is not conclusive about how active Pavel is. What is absolutely true, and that is confirmed by multiple sources, is that Prigozhin's son, Pavel, has inherited very many of Prigozhin's businesses, and these include military businesses, these include his multiple economic interests in Africa, and generally speaking, after Prigozhin's failed coup and after his death, it was announced that African affairs would continue as before. This is not quite so, because many things have changed. But as far as Pavel is concerned, the only thing, concrete thing about his participation is that he was allowed to continue with his businesses. Business as usual continues, and he's particularly interested in the political side of the affairs. The political side, what was named was the elections in South Africa, in Namibia, in Mozambique and Botswana. That is the results of their investigation. Otherwise, yes, Prigozhin's soldiers of fortune continue in Africa, although perhaps under different names within the different units, and they act very successfully, particularly in West Africa.
What would Pavel's agenda be for expanding influence into Southern Africa, and what would his modus operandi be to do so?
Look, one of the strong sides of Prigozhin's activities, he started using internet and started using social networks. When dealing with the Russian opposition very early in his career, and this was one of his greatest achievements, actually. Using internet using social networks is a very, very important thing in Africa. So this is one of the methods, I suppose, that could be used both in West Africa and here. The purpose, well, if you ask any of Prigozhin's troops, they will tell you that they are acting in the interests of the Russian state, that they are defending their motherlands and they are patriots, and they will do everything that Russia needs. Whether it is legal or illegal, sometimes it could be illegal, but what is legal? Whose laws are these? And this is exactly what some people in this country mention in this connection. Which constitution is it? Which law is it? It is all imposed on us by the West. That is why we are not interested in it. There's no doubt that if Wagner's companies, whether it is troll companies or military assistance or whatever, act in South Africa or Southern Africa, they would act in the interests of private interests of the company itself, and of course they would act in the interests of Russia. And many people think that interests of Russia are the same interests as South African interests. That is how it could happen, and that is the modus operandi.
Could we just go back to the origins of Wagner and who Prigozhin really was?
Well, Prigozhin is the childbirth of the wild early 1990s in Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union. He's approximately 10 years younger than Putin. During the Soviet era in the 1970s, he was a small criminal, thief. He was from St. Petersburg. Then he organized petty robber gang and robbed several flats, for which he was sentenced to 13 years in prison, of which he spent 10 in prison. And when he got out, that was exactly at the time after the collapse of the Soviet Union, when the country was collapsing, the structures were collapsing, and you could either succeed. You could become a millionaire overnight. You could become a criminal. You could organize whatever. And Prigozhin was certainly in a very good position to do that. He organized several businesses, starting very modestly with selling hot dogs and making some small petty money out of it, but that was certainly not enough. And he simultaneously started several other businesses, some legal, some semi-legal, some illegal. This was such a normal practice in the early 1990s. Everybody did it. So what he participated in, for example, construction business, the trade, and many other things. But one of the businesses he started, obviously the continuation of his hot dog selling, was a restaurant business, and several of his first restaurants failed, but he finally found a successful formula. Together with some partners, he found the money to refurbish an old ship, and opened a luxurious restaurant in it. The first time among his businesses was a casino business. To get a license, he had to meet with some officials of St. Petersburg. And that's how he came across Putin, and that's how he met Putin for the first time. He was getting a license from the board, which was headed by the mayor, and Putin was mayor's deputy. So that's how they met. But when Prigozhin's restaurant and then a network of restaurants succeeded, Putin started visiting it, and he brought there several heads of state, including George Bush Sr. and several other heads of state. As far as I remember, Jacques Chirac, the Japanese premier. So that was a very posh and famous place, the best, the most expensive place in St. Petersburg. So that is how he started. But simultaneously, as I said, this was not his main money. His main money was simultaneously juggling several businesses, and these several businesses could include anything. And one of his businesses was exactly the networks, private networks, which could manipulate social networks, participation in the social network, trailing the protest movement, just watching what are they organizing, whether there's going to be a meeting, is it going to be peaceful or not peaceful. That was how he continued his relations with the state. He organized Wagner out of the remnants of previous private military companies, which emerged. Many of them emerged in the early 1990s. So he organized them into this Wagner company. where the name came from. Of course, Prigozhin was not a military commander, and he was not a military person, generally speaking. So the name of the commander was Dmitry Utkin, who was an officer, a retired officer, and I think of the GRU, that is more reconnaissance or intelligence, and he was the military head of the Wagner Company. The name Wagner came from Utkin because he was an admirer of Nazi. He was a Nazi himself. He had the Nazi tattoos on his body. Simultaneously, he was, of course, a Russian nationalist. Such combinations do happen, as we know from Ukraine, where also some of the radical nationalists admired Hitler's tattoos, Nazi tattoos on their bodies. So that is the Wagner was the composer who was the favorite composer of Hitler. And so that was his call name, Utkin's call name, Wagner. That's how the company was got its name. Now, what is happening now after the failed coup is that the name Wagner still exists, but it is nothing like it was before. The former military components were dissolved into several different other companies. Some of them were incorporated in the GRU private military company, which is called Redoute. Some of them were incorporated in another private military company, which is called Storm. There are dozens and dozens and dozens of such companies now. They are organized by every big private business. They are organized by GRU, more than one. They are organized by, well, the private military company is Ahmat Regiment, organized by Kadyrov, the leader of Chechnya, and some, the Chechen Republic, Russian Chechen Republic. So several of them joined this Ahmat Regiment. So that is the situation now. The strength of the Wagner itself, we do not know, and how in particular the relations between this private company and the state are organized, we also do not know. The former Wagner was getting arms and money from the state. Putin spoke about it just after the coup, an attempted coup. So he said openly, yes, we were financing them, we were giving them arms, and they have betrayed us. The name, Prigozhin's name, is now, again, after being called a traitor by the head of state, it is now being turned into the name of a hero again, and it is being venerated again. So it is all very Russian history, it's very unusual. So that is the situation as it is now.
What do you think was the reason for their phenomenal success in Africa? What was their secret?
There is one secret, I think, and they discovered it themselves. Their involvement started in Libya, actually. They tried unsuccessfully to get the oil fields and the ports, to establish control over the ports. Now, the remainder of this close relationship with in East India, East Libya. They remained, but the first sort of incursion into Libya was not quite successful. It was much more successful in Sudan, where the first relations, official relations, were established during the visit of President al-Bashir, Sudanese president, to Moscow. Then Russia, Putin, has signed an agreement about the Russian establishing the military base on the Red Sea coast, and also about the possibility of prospecting for oil and gas, and also the permission, the contract of using of the gold mine. The Russians developed very close relationship with the rapid support force in eastern Sudan, where, as the media has been writing, Western media has been writing, they are trained. This is Wagner already. They supplied rapid support force with arms, and they trained some of their military force, actually. So this has become the formula. You get the access to natural resources, whether it is oil, whether it is gas, whether it is gold, whether it is diamonds or whatever, and then you pay with the military support of a particular leader, and that leader obviously has to be faithful to you and not give any economic resources to anybody else. And then you also train the local forces. This has become particularly important in West Africa, for example, in the Central African Republic, where the mode was exactly the same. The President Ouattara asked for assistance from the Russian state, military assistance, and it was during the second year of his presidency. And such assistance was given, but not in terms of regular military troops, but in terms of Wagner. They were not called the private military company or anything like that. They were called the specialist military advisors. And they helped to train the locals. Not many Russian military personnel is present there, but they train the locals, and they get the access to the local resources. If we take Sudan, for example, according to some calculations, about 30 tons of gold has been exported to Russia by in favor of Wagner, in favor of the Russian interests. I don't know how far it is, but that is on top of some oil that they have been also getting. So one of the most important things, I think, is that Prigozhin's trick of using the social networks. The social networks means that they can propagate their message very skillfully, knowing local interests, knowing the sore points. You can send one message to one group and another message to another group. You can use anti-American moods, anti-American sentiment of one group. You can use anti-imperialist sentiments of another group, anti-colonial sentiments of a third group. You can use all sorts of local tribal uses There was a publication about such a troll factory in Ghana, for example, which broadcast all over Africa. Unfortunately, the journalist did not uncover anything more except one conversation with a guy who was head of it, a Ghanaian who studied in the Soviet Union. This element, by the way, is very important because in Sudan, the Russians also found rapport with people who studied in Russia. And almost in every coup that happened in West Africa, there was somebody who was involved in that coup. Studied in Russia or in the USSR, was close to the Russian interests. So social networks are very, very important. And of course, not only the Russians are using it, not only the Wagner is using it. It's quite obvious. Everybody is doing that. And one of the most important messages as well in West Africa is the anti-colonial message. It is so popular. The new stage of liberation now is coming, and we have to liberate ourselves of new colonialism. We now want to be the masters of our fate. And the Russian presence, the Russian military assistance may be so important also because the Western message is failing. The Western message is to watch elections. We need regular elections. We need democracy. We need the rules. We need the business which is transparent. We need the laws which are fair. We are fighting corruption and so on and so forth. But West African countries are so poor. And you can... you know, all these messages do not work there. People are not interested in elections. They are not interested in democracy. They are not interested in constitution. They want stability and they want food on their table. And that is all. And that's the most important thing for them. And of course, with the presence of the Russian military, sometimes it works. There is more stability. Sometimes, in most cases, it doesn't work because there's just not enough troops, for example, to stop the Islamist attacks in West Africa. It remains to be seen how successful that attempt is. But the promise of stability, the promise of we now have, for example, in the Central African Republic, we have Touadera. We have stopped the endless coups and endless arguments with the opposition about who is now the president. By the way, if we speak about the Central African Republic, it is not uncommon, as it is in Sudan, to establish relations with both fighting sides. Because the Russians are not unfriendly with the opponents of the Touadera, the movement which is called SLEKA, that headed by the former president, and they are not unfriendly with that group either. The social networks, the message of anti-colonialism, not demanding any Western trinkets of democracy, transparency, the law, and that is very attractive to African societies, particularly poorly organized societies and starving societies and so on.
Lastly, with the influence of the West waning on the African continent, how strong do you think Russia's position is in Africa right now?
Look, the whole world is changing. If I look only on Russia, I think that it is a bit overextending itself. But on the other hand, if you look at the mode this private military companies operate, they do get money to become, I wouldn't say self-sufficient, but almost self-sufficient. That mode can be sustainable if that is acceptable to the African states. Look what is going on in Kenya, for example. There are no Russians, but there is mass disturbances, there's mass riots, there is mass demonstrations, and so on. So far, I haven't heard anything about the Russians, please come and save us. And the Kenya democratic institutions have been working, but I don't know what is going on social networks there. I would not be surprised if the Russian flag appears somewhere there as well, although noticeably this only happened in Western African countries, mostly of them former French colonies. So we'll have to see. I don't know for how long, but I said the world is changing. Yes, the Western influence is weakening everywhere in the world, not only in Africa. And in Africa in particular, the interests of China, the interests of Russia, the interests of the Arab countries, they are growing. If it is not Russia, China has a lot of influence in African countries. And I don't think the Chinese are also interested in the trinkets of any democracy or anything like that. I don't know how sustainable it is. It depends on the African people themselves, whatever they got, whatever they want. It's very difficult to say where it will end.
Thank you. That was SA Russia expert Professor Irina Filatova speaking to BizNews, and I am Chris Stain. Thank you, Professor.